Podcast, Wednesday, March 20th, 2013. Hey, Mac Geeks, it's time for your MacCast, the show for Mac Geeks by Mac Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MacCast. Glad to have you back here with me for another episode. We got a lot of great news and information to get into in this week's episode, but before we get started, I do want to take a quick moment and recognize a couple of our sponsors. First is Smile. They actually have a big new announcement. They just released yesterday an amazing update to an already amazing product. You all know I am a big fan of everything that Smile makes, and one of those applications that I rely on almost daily is PDF Pen, and they just released a big PDF Pen update, PDF Pen version 6 for both PDF Pen and PDF Pen Pro. If you deal with PDFs at all, and I think most of us do, you should invest in a copy of PDF Pen. If you need to annotate, you need to edit PDFs, it can do that. You can add your signatures, you can perform OCR on scanned PDFs, you can password protect your PDFs, keep your security in check. You can also manage your PDFs with Dropbox, Evernote, and with the Mac App Store version now, iCloud. So the new version is updated to a whole new look, and it's even optimized for Retina displays. And I have to tell you, it looks amazing. I was blown away when I opened it up for the first time. And it gives you now, I think, quicker access to all of the items and tools and things that you need to work with. Plus, it has some really amazing new features, including now the ability to export and convert your PDFs to Microsoft Word .doc and .docx formats. So you can actually take a PDF and convert it into an editable Microsoft Word document, and they use Nuance's OmniPage Cloud Document Conversion Service, so it works amazing. And that's in both the standard and the pro version. Now, if you get the pro version, that's the one that lets you work with forms. On that one, you can now automatically analyze a PDF, and it will create the form areas for you. So you used to have to do that by hand. Now you can automate the process, and it just saves you a ton of time when you're creating your PDF forms. And those are just two amazing new features from a whole list of amazing new stuff in the new version. So it's available now, and they are now offering it on the Mac App Store. And because currently the App Store doesn't offer upgrade pricing, through today, March 20th at midnight, PDF Pen is giving special pricing on the Mac App Store. You can get PDF Pen for just $29, $29.99 US, and you can get PDF Pen Pro for $39.99 US. And after that, the pricing is just $59.95 for PDF Pen and $99.95 for PDF Pen Pro. So it's a great deal either way. And if you're already an existing PDF Pen customer, they are offering upgrade pricing through the Smile website. You can get an upgrade version from the prior version for just $30 US. And if you want to upgrade from PDF Pen to PDF Pen Pro and you have a prior version of PDF Pen, the upgrade is just $40. So don't wait. Now is the time to grab what I really feel is the best PDF tool that you can get for your Mac. And while you're at it, don't forget they have PDF Pen for iPhone and iPad as well, so you can sync and edit your PDFs and take them on your iOS devices, take them on the go. So PDF Pen 6 available now from Smile, another great update to their already great lineup of products. Check them all out over at smilesoftware.com, and a big thank you to them for their support of the MacCast. I also want to thank and tell you about ShareFile by Citrix. You know, these days, most of your business emails and your communications involve some sort of attachment. You're attaching a document, a spreadsheet, maybe a PowerPoint, contract you need to send out to somebody, a PDF. And what you need to know is you need to know that that information gets received, it gets into the right hands, and more importantly, that it remains confidential. It gets to the person that you want it to get to, and that doesn't always necessarily happen. And that's why when Citrix was looking at the solutions out there, they wanted to build something that was really built for businesses and built to meet this need. ShareFile by Citrix allows you to send your attachments as secure links. So you can send files of almost any size. They're not going to get bounced by the receiving server's restrictions or the outgoing server's restrictions. You get a high degree of security, and you can receive notifications when your files are opened and you know by whom. So you know that they get opened by the correct person. And ShareFile is really easy to use. It integrates right into any business. Plus, with ShareFile, you can access those files from anywhere, on your laptop, on your tablet, on your smartphone. So I really recommend you trying out ShareFile. If you're not using ShareFile yet, you can sign up now. It's completely free, no credit card required, so you really have nothing to lose, and you can see for yourself why millions of professionals rely on it every day. To get started today with my free 30-day trial, just go to sharefile.com, click on the little microphone at the top of the homepage, and then enter my promo code MACCAST. That's sharefile.com, and type in the promo code MACCAST. And start using ShareFile today. And a big thank you to ShareFile and Citrix for their support of the MacCast. We're going to start off the news for this week with a story that's looking way into the future, a little bit further in the future than we would normally look when it comes to rumors. There is a report coming out of DigiTimes about Apple's next generation A-series processor, the A7 chip. They're reporting that Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturing Company is set to tape out Apple's new A7 processor in preparation for future production. The report came via CNET, who said the step is a move by Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturing to prep for a pilot production run of the A7 to begin sometime this summer. Tape-out is supposedly the final stage of the design cycle when the artwork, CAD rendering files and things like that for the chip design are sent to photomask a circuit and prep it for initial stages of manufacturing. It's also very likely that this tape out is just one of many that will happen. This is the first pilot chip production, and it's going to be tested and then tweaked. And so they're going to be working on this for a little while. And probably one of the reasons it's going to take a little while is that, according to the report, the A7 will use a new 20 nanometer manufacturing process. That's versus the current 28 nanometer process that TSMC uses. Apple still hasn't even moved their current processors over to TSMC, although that has been a rumor. The A-series manufacturing is being still done by Samsung at this point. They've been the sole supplier of Apple's A-series chips since Apple started creating their own custom chips for iOS devices. Last week, I think you'll remember, I reported that it seemed at first like the latest chips in the Apple TV might have come from Taiwan Semiconductor because they had a much smaller form factor. It was about 50% smaller, but it was later revealed by Chipworks after doing some additional analysis that it's just a newly designed chip still being manufactured by Samsung using their 32 nanometer process. And that's really amazing considering how much they scaled down the previous A5 design that was in the third generation Apple TV. So this is an update to the third generation Apple TV. It was a sort of quiet update that Apple did behind the scenes. They didn't change the form factor. It's not a new generation of Apple TV. It just has this smaller processor in it. It's still believed, though, that the next generation devices from Apple could have A-series chips made by Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturing using their current 28 nanometer process, but that remains to be seen. So we might see a version of the A6X using 28 nanometer from Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturing in the updated iPhone 5S. That's one of the rumors that's floating around out there. As for the A7, if it does end up being a 20 nanometer TSMC chip, the reports are, as I was saying at the beginning, it's not going to be for a while. This is a long time in the future. It's not going to get here till next year because TSMC is not expected to have its 20 nanometer process ready for chip production at least until early 2014. So we'll see that in the 2014 model of the iPhone, I guess the iPhone 6 or 6S. Maybe we'll see it. Likely we'll see the new processor in iPads before we see them in new iPhones. Along with the possibility of expanding its chip fabrication among suppliers, at least one analyst predicts Apple will expand assembly efforts of one of its iPhone vendors as well. KGI Securities analyst Ming-Chi Kuo said that Apple will expand their role, the role that their supplier Pegatron has played in iPhone production. To date, most iPhone production has been handled by Hanhai, division of Foxconn, and Pegatron has taken on a smaller role, at least with the iPhone. Pegatron has a long history, actually, of supplying Apple products like MacBooks and iPads and iPhones, but it's now believed, at least by Kuo and other industry watchers, that Apple will have a low-cost iPhone to introduce alongside the iPhone 5S, and may need some additional assembly help. So it makes sense that Apple would want to spread out production to meet demand. The thought is that Pegatron would be responsible for about 75% of the low-cost FDD LTE iPhone orders and about 55% of past-generation iPhone 4 and iPhone 4S production. Hanhai would then process about 100% of the iPhone or 100% of the iPhone 5S orders, according to the report, and 25% of the low-cost FDD LTE iPhone 5s. And then Foxconn would also be producing 100% of the low-cost TDD LTE iPhone 5s. Hanhai would continue to handle 100% of current iPhone 5 production as well. And in case you're wondering what these terms FDD, LTE, and FDD or TDD LTE are, I got confused even just saying them, but I had no idea what they were. The FDD LTE is apparently the kind of LTE used by most U.S. carriers like Verizon and AT&T. TDD LTE is backed by companies like Clearwire and, I guess more importantly, China Mobile. So that would be, I would assume, a version of the iPhone that would be distributed in China. According to Kuo, the increased orders from Apple would raise Pegatron's share, their total share of Apple's ODM, OEM business, about 9%, up from 18% in 2012 to 27% in 2013. So a much more significant role. Kuo still sees the iPhone 5S and the low-cost iPhone as arriving sometime this summer and predicts that Apple will sell 35.8 million iPhone 5S models and 53.4 million low-cost iPhone 5s by the end of 2013. So the iPhone, the low-cost iPhone 5, at least according to Kuo, could be a big portion of Apple's iPhone business. Overall, if you add in the current iPhone 5, the iPhone 4S, and the iPhone 4, the analyst sees Apple shipping about 110 million units in the second half of 2013, which would be an increase of about 83% over the first part of this year. When Apple introduces a new iPhone, of course, sales are going to increase, but an 83% increase is very significant, and I'm sure would be a welcome increase to Apple's bottom line. As far as a few of the details that we're hearing about the specs of the low-cost iPhone 5 at this point, it's predicted to have the same 4-inch Retina display as Apple's current generation iPhone 5. The case is expected to be a plastic case somewhere between 0.4 and 0.6 millimeters thick, and it's still believed that it will be available in multiple colors, maybe 4 to 6 new colors coming along with the traditional black and white versions. So maybe a couple more months before we hear Apple announce something about new iPhones, and we'll see if all of these rumors end up being valid or not. Apple released a new version of the iMac on its website last week, but it's very likely that you probably missed it. It's probably not as big of an update as you might think. There's no new processor, no better GPU, no bigger or cheaper flash storage options. So you might be wondering, well, why the update then? What exactly does it bring back? Well, it actually brings back something that was lost when Apple did the new thin redesign last year, and it's something that a number of people really depend on and use, and that's VESA mounting. In November and December, when the new iMacs started shipping, those who relied on wall mounts and desk arms for their iMacs found that they were out of luck. the new designs didn't have that compatibility. Well, that changed this week when Apple added a new $40 build-to-order option available on their website. They even set up a whole new page on the store to explain things. I'll have a link in the show notes at maccast.com. But the most significant thing you need to know about this new model is it uses a whole different casing. So if you order one of these, you need to have a VESA mount available for it. It's not built in. It's not included. So you need to have a stand or an arm. And I guess if you change your mind in the future, you're sort of out of luck. Well, probably not, because I'm guessing that there's really no shortage of VESA-compatible desktop stands that you could get. And if not, I bet you there's going to be some third parties who are going to jump on the chance to make one that's worthy of the new iMac design. Or at the very least, there's going to be some sort of Kickstarter project to kick up, right? And these new VESA iMacs are available now. They're shipping in 7 to 10 days in the U.S., which is just a small delay over the 24-hour ship times of most of the standard stand models of the iMac. Late last week, Apple released an update to OS X Mountain Lion, OS X Mountain Lion update version 10.8.3. It includes features and fixes that improve the stability, compatibility, and security of your Mac, according to Apple. Included in the feature and bug fix list is the ability to redeem iTunes gift cards in the Mac App Store using your Mac's built-in camera. Bootcamp support for installing Windows 8, also bootcamp support for Macs with a 3 terabyte hard drive, so that would include those new iMacs. A fix for an issue that could cause a file URL to quit applications unexpectedly. There was also a fix for Logic Pro to deal with an issue where Logic Pro could become unresponsive when using certain plugins. And they fixed an audio stutter issue on 2011 iMacs. The update also included Safari 6.0.3, so if you haven't upgraded to that yet, when you run the 10.8.3 update, you will be updated to Safari 6.0.3, so be aware of that. And if when I mentioned the new feature to redeem gift cards using your iSight camera, you scratch your head and said, didn't we already get that feature as part of iTunes 11? You would not be alone. I noticed that several sites seem to misinterpret that new feature, thinking that it was something that came out in iTunes 11. And while that's correct, iTunes 11 did gain that feature where you can hold a gift card in front of the iSight camera to redeem it. That was part of iTunes. This new feature in the 10.8.3 update brings that functionality to the Mac App Store, which until now still required manually typing in your gift card number. So that's the difference, and definitely can be a little bit confusing with how it was listed out and reported by Apple. Some other things that came out after the update, a possible side benefit for MacBook Pro owners is that you might see slightly increased battery life. Jim Tanis over at the Mac Observer has been doing extensive battery tests on each release of Mountain Lion since users reported a significant battery decrease after the original 10.8 update to Mountain Lion. I'll have a link to his article over at the Mac Observer, but in essence, through the testing, it was revealed that 10.8.2, the last update, restored most people to their normal battery life. And on this round, the Mac Observer found that their test system at least gained about 23 minutes of battery life. So not a huge increase, and your results may vary depending upon which model you have, but at least it looks like things in the battery department have either stayed the same or are possibly getting better. Some other items to note about the Safari 6.0.3 update: it included a number of fixes, including one kind of odd one. It improves the scrolling on Facebook.com. So interesting to see something in a Safari update targeted at just one website. Additional fixes and updates in the Safari upgrade are improved scrolling while zoomed into a web page, improved performance on web pages that use plugin content, a fix for an issue that could cause the inaccurate appearance of an alert that would warn you when bookmarks can't be changed, a fix for an issue that could cause duplicate bookmarks to appear on your iOS device after editing bookmarks in Safari in Mac OS X, a fix for an issue that permitted users to access unfiltered search results from Google.com even when parental controls were enabled, so good thing that they fixed that. And then finally, a fix for an issue that could prevent Safari from restoring the last position on a web page when you navigate back to it. Now I just wish they would issue a fix for the forced tab refresh thing that I see all the time. I'd be really happy if they could do something about that. I don't know if you've ever seen it, but often when I'll have multiple tabs open in Safari, be working, I come back to Safari and the whole thing sort of locks up while every tab has to manually be forced to reload. I don't know if that's a sandboxing thing or what's going on there, but really annoying nonetheless. An additional update that came out for MacBook Pro Retina users, MacBook Pro Retina SMC update version 1.1, it resolved a rare issue where users could experience slow frame rates when playing graphic-intensive games on the 15-inch systems. Also fixes a bug related to power nap and the wake from sleep functions. And then according to Apple Insider, this update may also address a fan control issue that was discovered about a week ago. I think I told you about that on the last episode. Some users had reported an issue where the fans would speed up and unexpectedly spike. It was believed that it was possibly related to some of the units that used flash storage from SanDisk, although there were some additional users with Samsung Flash who reported having the same problem. According to Apple Insider, this may also fix that issue. So if you have a 15-inch Retina MacBook Pro, you probably want to grab this latest SMC update. And if you haven't upgraded to 10.8.3 and you're running Mountain Lion, you can get that update by launching the App Store and running your updates using Apple's software update from System Preferences, or just heading over to Apple's support website at apple.com/support. For those wondering when we will see a Retina update to the iPad mini, it's looking more and more like it's not going to happen this spring, as some have predicted, but more likely going to happen this fall, echoing rumors from KGI Securities, as well as iMore, an analyst from Display Research, says he expects Apple to ship a Retina iPad in the third or fourth quarter of this year. According to Supply Chain Checks, the analyst believes the panel will likely be produced by LG Display, but he also doesn't rule out AU Optronics, Sharp, or Japan Display as potential partners either. The belief is that the display will be 2048 by 1536 pixels, which is good because it would maintain the aspect ratio and resolution of the current generation full-sized iPad. That's good news for developers, and it brings the 7-inch display pixel density all the way up to 324 pixels per inch, which is just right above Apple's mythical 300 pixel per inch Retina range, but still below some of the Retina busting resolutions that we've seen from some of Apple's competitors. The challenge for Apple's display partners will be packing all of those pixels in and still keeping the thinness of the iPad mini, keeping that extremely slim profile. As a matter of fact, the report points out that Apple may have to sacrifice a little bit of that thinness for the sake of the resolution, something that they were willing to do back when they moved from the non-Retina iPad to the current one. So we don't expect a millimeter or two to really stop them from releasing a Retina iPad mini update. There is still some belief that Apple will have an update for the 9.7-inch iPad with Retina display soon, sometime in the next few months. As to why they won't update the mini to Retina at the same time, for me, I think it's mostly about volume. I don't think this is about technology. I think the current model of the iPad mini is selling so well right now that Apple really doesn't want to rush a new one out, because anytime they add new components, especially a significant one like a Retina display, their parts costs are going to go up, which eats into their margins. And we know that the iPad mini already has a smaller margin than Apple is used to on their iPads. So, you know, I say, why kill a good thing? If sales are going really well, they can make more profit on the current generation one. They'll continue to do that, and they'll time the update to the iPad mini as they see sales start to trail off. That's likely to happen toward the end of the summer. moving into the new into the holiday season of 2013, Apple's going to want to get something new out on the market to kind of juice up sales. And so that's probably the right timing and most likely when we're going to see the update. I think Apple is going to stick on this twice a year release cycle for the iPad, where we see the 9.7-inch iPad come out in the spring, and then the iPad mini get its update along with iPods in the fall. Apple recently extended their standard warranty coverage on Macs in Australia, but they're not really advertising that fact to many consumers. The change came not by choice, but because Apple was not conforming to regional consumer law. The law in Australia states that statutory warranties should stand for a quote-unquote reasonable period of time, even after the manufacturer's standard warranty has expired. What's interesting is that Australia doesn't necessarily specify what a reasonable period of time is, but apparently Apple has now decided that that translates into 2 years, which is the coverage that you're going to get if you live in that region. Apple reportedly notified their Apple Store employees and staff via an email, and they also let their authorized resellers know about the change through the web portal. The Australian Apple blog MacTalk claims that they obtained internal emails from at least one Apple retail store, though, that told their associates not to talk to consumers about the new policy. Speculation is that Apple worries that it may hinder sales of AppleCare warranties that extend the standard coverage, which, again, in Australia is now 2 years, by only one more year. In other regions like the U.S., the standard coverage is 1 year, and buying AppleCare gives you another 2 years on top of that for a total of 3 years of coverage. Apple has been accused before of not being forthcoming with their consumers about warranty rights in different countries. As a matter of fact, just this week, the European Union's Justice Commissioner asked member states to review whether or not Apple had been properly advertising to buyers information about their 2 year warranty rights on Macs. Apple was actually fined, if you remember, almost 900,000 euros or 1.2 million US back in December of 2011 for allegedly informing consumers that they only had a 1 year warranty from Apple. Apparently, Apple still just advertises their Apple 1 year limited warranty in their stores, but on the EU websites, they have a page outlining EU customers' statutory warranty rights. It's probably enough to get them to be in compliance with regional laws, but good luck finding it. I'll have a link to it in the show notes at maccast.com, at least the UK one. It looks like all of the European Union countries have a similar page. And so I'd be curious to know what those of you in other countries think about this. Are consumers relatively informed about these statutory rights, or should Apple be doing something to be more forthcoming? It does give the appearance that Apple's trying to sort of conceal the fact that you get this additional coverage so that they can make a little bit more money on those AppleCare warranties, which is a significant profit center for them, from what I understand. I think regardless, I would probably still get the AppleCare warranty. Most of the time when I've used mine, it's been in that second to third year period. Sometimes it'll happen where you'll have a failure early on, but that's usually a known bug, and that's usually covered by the standard warranty. But every time I've needed the extended warranty coverage, it seemed to be more toward the end of the life of my Apple product rather than toward the beginning. So it's kind of a tough call. Is 1 year of additional coverage enough for consumers to go ahead and bite the bullet, or does Apple need to do a little bit more? I really don't know. I'd be curious to get your opinions. It looks like as supply constraints lift up on the new iMac models, Mac sales continue to improve. Piper Jaffray analyst Gene Munster took a look at the latest NPD Mac sales numbers and noted that things are looking up for Apple. It looks like U.S. Mac sales for the January-February timeframe are up about 14% year over year. The 14% aggregate for the two-month period is still down from the 31% growth that we saw in January alone, but it's still looking good, like good growth for the quarter if things continue as they are. Worldwide, though, the quarter looks like it will end up slightly down for Mac sales. Munster says that Apple will likely report an overall 5% decline in Mac sales for the quarter. And then finally for this week, I'll leave you with a couple of iOS updates that came through just yesterday. iOS 6.1.3 was released to specifically address a bug that could allow someone to bypass the lock screen and access the iPhone app on your iOS device. That was a pretty well widely reported security flaw in iOS 6.1.2 that has been patched. And it also brings improvements to Apple Maps in Japan. Many of these, I guess, were apparently released in an over-the-air non-iOS update, but it looks like this update in iOS 6.1.3 brings some additional enhancements. Some of the things that are in there are improved pronunciation of roads during turn-by-turn navigation, added labels for junctions and interchanges and on-ramps, off-ramps, and intersections, updated freeway color to green, additional 3D buildings including Tokyo Station, Japan Imperial Palace, and Tokyo Tower, along with a bunch of other improvements specifically for Japan. Along with the iOS 6.1.3 update, Apple also did update the Apple TV software to version 5.2.1 for second and third generation Apple TVs. It brings a number of bug fixes and enhancements, most significantly an entirely new Hulu app, which has been redesigned with improved discovery tools as well as a more simplified UI and enhancements. So if you're a Hulu subscriber and an Apple TV owner, you surely want to grab this latest 5.2.1 update. And they're both available by running software update on your iOS device, and 6.1.3 can also be acquired by running software update in iTunes. And with that, that'll do it for the news for this week. Before we move on, I want to take a quick moment and thank another one of our show sponsors, and that is GoToMeeting by Citrix. You know, when your entire team can get together, it's amazing what you can get accomplished. Projects that might drag on for weeks, decisions that take days going back and forth over email to get resolved, all of those delays can get solved with a simple face-to-face meeting. Right then and there, you can get stuff done. But the trouble these days is pulling everyone together into a single location can often be inefficient. It's time-consuming, might even be impossible depending upon where your workers are and what's going on with your business. And that's why you need GoToMeeting with HD Faces. It solves the issue, making it easy for your entire team to get together and do it online. So it doesn't matter where your team is located, you can get together when and where you need to. Best of all, GoToMeeting is really simple to use and offers powerful features. You can share screens and documents so everybody can be on the same page. You get HD video so it looks like you're in the same room even when you aren't. And it's simple to launch or join a meeting from almost anywhere using a computer, a smartphone, a tablet. You can even present from your iPad, and that is really cool. I use GoToMeeting with my clients all the time. As a matter of fact, I'm able to chat with clients wherever they're located, whether they're down the street. I don't have a physical office, so I don't have a place where people can come to meet. This gives me a virtual space, and it doesn't matter if they're close, if they're local, or even if they're across the country, or even in another country. I have some clients down in Australia, and I'm able to work with them and collaborate and get stuff done. Plus, I save time because I can see them, I can share my documents, I can show them my screen. So if there's trouble understanding something, maybe an interface or a website design or an admin control panel that I've built, I can share my screen and I can actually show them what they need to do, where they need to go, and it really saves time. And that translates to saving money for my business. So you can try GoToMeeting completely free for 30 days. Don't wait on this. Use this special offer. Just visit GoToMeeting.com, click on the Try It Free button, and use my promo code MACCAST. Remember to use the promo code MACCAST when you sign up at GoToMeeting.com, and you'll get your free trial, and you'll see how great GoToMeeting really is. I really like the product, and a big thank you to Citrix and GoToMeeting for their support of the MacCast. On the last episode, we got into a pretty deep discussion related to a question someone had about sharing files between users on the same Mac. So he had multiple user accounts and wanted an easy way to share documents between those accounts, but give everybody read and write access to those shared files. So simply a shared folder where the permissions were set in a way where anybody working on those documents could collaborate on them, read, write, and do what they needed to do. And it turned out to be a pretty tricky problem to solve. It was easy to create a folder where you could put a document and someone else could access it. As a matter of fact, it's built right into OS X, right? You can go into the users folder and there's a shared documents folder. But the problem is when you share a file in there, the default permissions are to be read-write by the owner of that document, and then anybody else can read it, but they can't write to it. So they'd have to create a copy, and then you end up with all these multiple copies, and that wasn't the solution we were looking for. Now, it's easy enough to go in, select file, get info, and change those permissions, but that's also tedious, and the solution we were looking for was something a little bit more automated. So we got into this deep conversation about access control lists and POSIX permissions in Unix. If you missed that conversation, go back and listen to it. But I got some great feedback on this week and some additional suggestions that may work for some of you. As a matter of fact, Mike wrote me to suggest that you might be able to use this what's called the sticky bit in Unix on the folder so that OS X will inherit the permissions. Now, I played around with this a little bit, and either my Unix foo is not up to snuff, or in OS X I'm doing something wrong, or maybe OS X isn't doing a standard implementation of the Unix POSIX permissions, but anyway, I couldn't necessarily get it to work. But it's worth looking into. If you just search for sticky bit OS X permissions on Google, you get a bunch of articles and information. I read someplace that the sticky bit doesn't work for inheriting POSIX permissions, so maybe that's part of the issue. But certainly digging into access control lists does work, and I guess this may or may not get around having to mess around with those, but worth a try, and thanks to Mike for at least suggesting it. Alan also had a great suggestion. He said, why not just use an Apple script and assign it to the folder you want to share using a folder action, and then have that Apple script, anytime a document is added to that folder, rewrite the permissions for you. And as a matter of fact, he even provided instructions and a sample Apple script that we could use. So I posted it in the follow-up section in the forum at maccast.com. So if you go to forum.maccast.com, look in the show follow-up section, you'll find my post. I will also have a link to it in the show notes at maccast.com so you can get to it easily. But basically, what you're going to want to do is open up your Apple script editor. That you'll find that in the applications folder inside utilities. So open the Apple script editor application, and then you can copy and paste the example in. Tweak it if you'd like, but I tested it as is, and it does work. So just paste it in there, and then you're going to save the script into your home folder, into the library folder, and then inside the scripts folder, inside a folder called Folder Action Scripts. And if you don't see those folders there, you may have to create them. I actually had to create a scripts folder and a folder action scripts folder inside that, and then I saved my file into there. Now, name it something relevant. I used share with all users as the name of my script file. And I think Alan recommended saving it as an application, but if you actually just save it as a script, as an Apple script, you can come back and edit it and tweak it later if you need to. So go ahead and save it in that location, and then you can get out of the Apple script editor and then go into the Finder and create the folder that you'll use to share your documents with the other user accounts. And I would do this in a place where everybody can already access those files. So a good place would be in that user shared folder, or even in your home folder inside your public folder, which is a default folder in OS X that everybody on the OS, all the user accounts on the OS have access to. So create that folder in there. And then what you can do is you can control click or right click on that folder and choose the folder actions setup. And that will pop open a new window and pull down a sheet, and you should be able to see your script listed in that sheet. So select your script that you just saved and attach it to that folder. And then back in the setup window, you're going to want to make sure you check on enable folder actions, and then also make sure that your script is checked on in the column on the right. And once you have those two things, you can close the setup window, and then that's it. So from this point forward, now if you save or copy a file into that folder, your script should automatically run and change the permissions so that everybody in the group, which if you remember from last week, the default group is staff, meaning staff is the group for any user account in OS X, that group will have write access to any files saved into that folder. Now, note that folder actions are assigned per user account, so you'll need to create the script under each user account and assign it to that same folder to get the permissions for the files to change for that user as well. If you want to save the script just once, you can actually originally save it into the root library scripts folder, action scripts folder, rather than the one in your home user library, and then it will be available to all users on the system. So you can just write it once, and then you just have to assign it to the folder action for each user, but you can reuse the same Apple script. So that might make things a little bit easier. And then the only other thing that I noticed was that when a user makes a change and saves it into that shared document folder, they become the new owner of the document. That shouldn't be a problem if you're sharing between multiple users on the same system, but just be aware of that. It is going to swap the owner back and forth. You're likely not going to notice it, though, but if you pop open Git Info, you might be wondering, hey, I created that file originally. Why is that other user account the new owner? And it just means that they probably went in and made a change to that file, which they can do now. So I thought that was a great suggestion by Alan and another good way to set up the sharing between multiple user accounts in OS X. So a big thank you to both Mike and Alan for their suggestions. If you have any other tips or suggestions, or if you know why I couldn't necessarily get that sticky bit thing to work, let me know. I also have a screencast that I sent to Mike, so maybe he'll follow up. And if I figure this out with his help, I'll follow up on a future episode. Received an email this week from Brian, and Brian is looking to upgrade his airport base station and had a question that I commonly get when someone is in the market for a new Apple router. And that question inevitably is, should I get a time capsule instead of just an airport base station? Because I want to enable over-the-air backups using Time Machine. And that's really what most folks are looking for, is they're looking for a network backup solution that doesn't require connecting a USB hard drive to each one of their Macs. Many of us have multiple Macs. A lot of them are on our Wi-Fi networks. And so it really is convenient. And more importantly, though, with any kind of backup solution, you want reliability and you want it to be always on for the wireless support without having to maybe have it connected to a Mac. So you want to take the Mac out of the equation and just have this sort of network drive that you can back up your different Macs to. And in my opinion, the time capsule is somewhat limited. I think that one thing is it couples your airport to the internal hard drive in sort of a single closed solution. So if either one of those things fail, you kind of have to swap out the whole thing, right? I guess you could continue to use the airport by itself if the hard drive failed, but then you sort of have this thing that has functionality that you've lost. So I like to think of, you know, a two-part solution where your router is separate from your backup solution or your storage solution. The other thing about the time capsule, in my opinion, is you get 2 terabytes of storage for $299, $300, but that's likely not enough for Time Machine backups for multiple Macs. I guess it depends on what kind of Macs you have. If you have a bunch of MacBook Airs that only have 128 gigabyte flash drives in them or flash storage in them, then you might be okay. But if you're like me and you have a lot of Macs that have 500 gigabyte or 1 terabyte hard drives, you know my rule of thumb for Time Machine is you generally want twice the amount of storage that you would have internally on your Mac. So if you had 2 500 gigabyte Macs, then you would eat up all of your storage. And if you wanted to do a third using your time capsule, well, you'd have to give up some of the how far you can go back in your Time Machine backups. And especially if you have movie and music and photo libraries, so even if you have a MacBook Air that has a smaller internal drive, you might have attached to that an external drive that has a bunch of movie and iTunes and photo content, and that is usually very large, typically much larger than even a terabyte or so. And you want to make sure all of that gets backed up in your Time Machine backup. So I really think for most people, you're going to need more storage than the 2 terabytes that a time capsule provides. So the follow-up to this when I talk to people about this is typically, well, what about using airport disk on an Airport Extreme. This is a really cool feature in your Airport Extreme. You can actually attach an external USB hard drive to the USB port on the back of that and share that out through the airport without requiring a Mac. And so you could hook on any size external USB drive that you'd want. And that would be an awesome solution for network Time Machine backups if only Apple supported it. And they don't, and I have no idea why. I think you can actually make it work, but it's not officially supported by Apple, so they don't recommend it, so I typically don't recommend it. You can give it a try. There's tutorials online and ways of making it work, but it all seems a little bit kludgy, and I've never heard of anybody having really good success with that. If you have had good success with it, maybe it's gotten better since I played around with it, but again, it's not one of those ones that I typically recommend to most people. So what are your options? Well, if you don't mind spending a little bit more, I would look into some sort of what I would call true, quote-unquote, NAS product that supports Time Machine. And there's actually a lot of popular solutions out there that support Time Machine now, including Drobo's. And the one that I'm hearing a lot of good things about, I don't have one yet, but I'm seriously considering picking one up, but it's the Synology Disk Station. And there's a bunch of different models. Synology.com is the company. You can find them on Amazon. This can be a little bit more of an expensive solution, but it's much more flexible, in my opinion. They have a diskless two-bay solution for around $299 US, so about the same price as a time capsule. And you can get 2 terabyte bare hard drives now for around $100 each, maybe a little bit more than $100 US. And so you pop two of those in there, you mirror them, and you can essentially replicate a 2 terabyte storage solution that works with Time Machine that doesn't couple your storage to your Airport Express base station. So get an Airport Express base station, get one of these, hook them both up on your network, and you're good to go. And you can even hardwire the whole thing using gigabit Ethernet. So for Macs that you can hardwire, it's going to be a lot faster when performing backups, and I think more reliable. Wireless can get flaky from time to time. If you want wireless support in the disk station, they do have a few models that have wireless built in. They also have USB ports on the back that you can hook in a wireless dongle to add wireless connectivity. I think it uses, you know, a Linux variant of an operating system, so you can get in there and you can configure all kinds of things with them. And what's great about this is that you can also expand your storage as your needs grow. So they have a two-bay solution. That's kind of their, I think they even have one disk solutions if you want that, but they also have multiple bay solutions all the way up to like 8 bays. So you can really expand this out as much as you want, depending upon which model you pick up. And you can raid the drives so you can get added redundancy in your backups. It's really a flexible and very powerful solution. And you can use it for other things as well. So you don't have to just use it for your Time Machine backups. You can actually slice out a portion for different Macs for Time Machine backups. But then if you have extra storage, or if you get a larger unit where you can put more hard drives in, you could also use it for media sharing, for file sharing. It has print server functionality, including support for AirPrint. And so you can hook your USB printer in there and get airport printing capabilities. It has AirPlay streaming support for your Apple TV. So if you want to put videos on there, you can stream those directly over AirPlay to your Apple TV. It really is a cool unit. But like I said, it's going to be more expensive than just going with something like a time capsule. So just be prepared for that. As I mentioned also, I think the Drobo FS and maybe some of the other models of Drobo also support Time Machine, but I've heard mixed reviews on how that works. And even when I went to look into it on Drobo's website, there were some significant warnings about setting it up and how to set it up properly and stuff like that. I think you can do it as long as you go through the process, but that kind of stuff makes me nervous. I'd like solutions that seem to be or tend to be just simple plug and play and you're good to go. And I think anybody who's looking for a time capsule, that's the kind of solution that you're looking for. Another thing I ran across as I was doing my research is Netgear also makes something called the Centria, which has a 3.5-inch SATA hard drive slot that you can plug a bare drive into. And according to 9to5 Mac, does work with both wired and wireless Time Machine backups. So this is a router 802.11 A, B, G, and N dual band 4-port gigabit router that also has a slot where you can plug in and basically build your own kind of time capsule drive that will work reportedly with Time Machine. Again, I haven't tried this solution, but it's out there on the market. It also offers the USB printer sharing with AirPrint support. And on Amazon, the pricing when I looked it up was $185 US for the router without a hard drive. If you want to get it pre-installed with a 2 terabyte hard drive, it was $349. So I would go with the bare model and buy my own drive, my own 2 terabyte drive, and put it in there. But another option for you. Ultimately, though, if you're still on a budget, I would seriously consider, and I think the most cost-effective solution is just getting an external USB hard drive for each Mac that you want to do a Time Machine backup on and plugging it in. Even if it's a MacBook Air, something like that, it's easy enough to just take the USB cable once in a while and plug it in. It does require that you do that once in a while, which I know for some people these days is pretty hard. I'm finding with my iOS devices, I very rarely hook them in, and I forget that, you know, I'm doing over-the-air backups, but if I don't plug them into power, if I don't manually sync them up, I'm not getting my backups. And I've noticed from time to time I'll go weeks without having backed up my iOS devices. So I could imagine the same sort of problem comes into play if you have something like a MacBook Air that's always connecting over wireless. You never hook anything into it. But if you can just, you know, I don't know, put a reminder in your iCal to once a week plug it in, or once every couple days plug it in so that you get your Time Machine backups run, then I think that's really the most cost-effective solution. And then just buy a standard AirPort Extreme base station as your router and you're good to go. But that's kind of my thoughts on the subject. I hope that, Brian, that helps you out, maybe gives you some ideas, some things to look into. And if any of you have additional suggestions for sort of solving this problem, or maybe you have had better experience with the time capsule than I have. I know a bunch of people who have them who really love them. So I'm not trying to not sell you on a time capsule. I'm just saying for my money, I think I'd spend it a little bit differently. I know I'm really late to this party, but I finally upgraded my main work Mac, the MacBook Pro that I use on a daily basis, to Mountain Lion. I know it took me a really long time, but I just had a bunch of critical projects that I wanted to make sure were finished up before I started messing around with the core of my system, especially because I wanted to do a complete clean reinstall of my operating system. In case you're wondering how that process went, I did a full episode for MacCast members on how I did my full clean install of Mountain Lion. But now that I have it on my daily system, not just an extra system that I played around and do testing and presenting with, I'm getting to play with the features in a lot more deep way. And Notification Center is one of those features that I'm messing around with. And this week there was a great tip, or I think it might have been last week, there was a great tip posted by Erica Sadoun over at the Unofficial Apple Weblog, and it was about how to change the default alert sound in the Notification Center in Mountain Lion. I think it uses the frog, is that what it's called? Alert sound, something like that. No, it uses the Basso alert sound, and I think she said it sounds like a frog passing gas. Is that the nice way to say that? She didn't particularly like the default alert sound in Notification Center, and you know, I'm not a huge fan of it either. I think it could be a little bit more creative, and so this tip was how to change that. And I think, backing up a little bit, one thing that many people don't know about is that it's actually fairly easy to add your own custom system alert sounds to OS X, and this functionality has been available for a while. You know, back in the day when we were on Mac OS 9 and earlier versions, there was a lot of customization you could do to the operating system. We lost a little bit of that in the transition over to OS 10 and a Unix-based operating system, but there's still a lot of things you can do to tweak your system, and this is one of the relatively more simple kinds of hacks. And so the key to this one is finding a bunch of short AIFF files that you want to use as system alerts. You tend to want them to be short because otherwise they're going to play for a long time. You could put longer ones in there, but it's going to be a bit annoying every time, you know, an alert comes up if you have to listen to a 30-second clip or a minute-long clip. So typically you're going to want them to be 1 second or less, maybe a couple seconds, but find a short AIFF file that you want to use as your alert sound. And you can even create your own using QuickTime Pro or GarageBand. It's relatively easy to do. And then use that as your alert sound. As a matter of fact, when I was doing some research for this article, and I'll put a link to it in the show notes at maccast.com, Mac Update has a bunch of the old classic Mac sounds, including things like quack and wild eep and all those great sounds from the early Mac days. And so I used a couple of those as some of my new system alerts. So what you do is, once you have your AIFF files, all you have to do is add the sounds so that they show up in the system preferences under sounds under the sound effects tab. And to do that, all you have to do is put them in your home library sounds folder. So if you go into that folder, and remember in OS X Lion and Mountain Lion, to get to the library folder, you need to go under the Go menu while holding down the Option key, and you should see the library folder show up. And something I like to do once I've located the library folder is I throw it into my sidebar so that I have quick and easy access to it. But go into Library Sounds and then just drop your AIFF files in there. And then once you've done that, when you go into System Preferences, into Sounds, and look under the Sound Effects tab, you'll see your new custom sounds listed there. And whatever the name of the sound file is, the AIFF file, is what's going to show up as the name in the list. And you can tell that they're your custom sounds because under the Type column, it will say custom. And so you can select any one of those, you can preview it, and you can set those up as your system alerts, as your system beeps. And so that's pretty cool. Now, to change the default notification center alert sound, what you're going to do is you're going to override the default system sound Basso, B-A-S-S-O, is one of the default system sounds. And you're going to do that by adding an AIFF file to this same location into your home folder, library sounds folder, and giving it that exact name, B-A-S-S-O with a capital B dot A-I-F-F. And once you place that sound file into that folder, you will have to restart the notification center process. I think the easiest way to do this would be to simply just reboot your Mac. I think that should work. But in Erica's article, she pointed out that you can also kill the notification center process using the terminal. So I'll have instructions on how to do this in the show notes at maccast.com. In case you're not comfortable doing it, I would say just, reboot your Mac or log out and log back in. That might be enough to do it. But if you need to, you can issue the terminal command kill all space notification center in the terminal, and that should restart the notification center process automatically. And you can actually verify that the process has been restarted by running the ps-ax command and then running it through a grep search. And so if you don't know what all that is, then you probably don't want to be messing around in the terminal. Just do a reboot. But if you followed along with that, that's how you can check to make sure that the process has been restarted. But then once that's done, you can test your new notification center alert sound by simply setting up a reminder in the Reminders app and setting it to be a timed reminder that will go off in just a minute or two. So set that up. Just go into Reminders. Be sure to have it set up in Notification Center so that it will play the alert sound. So you're going to want to double check in System Preferences under Notifications for Reminders that it does play a system sound. But once you've done that, when your timer goes off or when your reminder goes off, you should hear your new alert sound if everything went well. If not, go back, retry the process. And again, I will have a link in the show notes at maccast.com to the original article by Erica Sadoun that walks you step by step through this process. And the sound is only for the default alerts in Notification Center. I noticed that some applications like Mail or Tweetbot, they actually have their own custom alert sounds, and you're not going to be overriding those. So this only changes the sound for the default Notification Center alert sounds. So just be aware of that. But a pretty cool little hack and a lot of fun and relatively simple to do. I think I've mentioned this several times in recent months, but I have now been buying a lot more of my movie and TV show content directly from iTunes rather than doing what I used to do in the past, which was buy DVDs. And the main reason I started doing that was because Apple added the ability for me to re-download the content from the iTunes store. So as an example, I recently bought The Hobbit. I also recently bought the last two seasons of Game of Thrones, and it's been really nice to be able to buy that stuff digitally and not have to worry about constantly backing up large volumes of data. That was always my problem with buying stuff directly, was that I was going to have to sort of manage gigabytes and terabytes of data and maintain that over time, and it seemed like a big hassle to me. Well, I got an email this week from Rick, and he rightly pointed out a potential flaw with me putting too much faith in Apple and them always having that data available and there ready for me to re-download. And the point was is that Apple doesn't always control their access, or by proxy, my access to that data. Movie and TV show licensing deals can be terminated. They often have to be renegotiated. A studio might choose at some point to pull their content from iTunes. And if they do that, it may or may not be available for me to re-download. And the same actually goes for apps. We've seen this in the past. A developer might pull a version of an app, or Apple could even pull a version for some sort of App Store rule violation, and it might suddenly become unavailable. So even on Apple's own knowledge base, they have an article on re-downloading past purchases from the App Store, the iBook Store, and the iTunes Store. And officially, they say this, quote unquote, "It is recommended that you always back up your iTunes library in the event that a purchased item is no longer available on the iTunes Store. For information about backing up your library, you can refer to that Tech Info article, and I'll try to have a link to that in the show notes at mattcast.com. But the point is that I guess I'm going to now be setting up a new ChronoSync task to copy my iTunes files over to my Drobo. I actually think I have that already happening, but I just need to make sure that I always download my new movie purchase. Sometimes I stream them directly to my Apple TV. So I'm going to need to make sure I download it to my Mac, that it gets backed up, and that I've got it set up to not remove old copies of movies from my Drobo via the ChronoSync backup when I remove them from iTunes. And I think that's a default setting that I use. So anything that I add gets backed up, and anything that I remove stays on the backed up copy that I have on my Drobo. I might also at this point now consider getting a second hard drive just to back up my iTunes purchases and have another copy of those. And, you know, they're also getting backed up to my Crash Plan. But obviously, when I remove that from Crash Plan, even though Crash Plan keeps versions, they eventually will delete those off. So I need to have something that is more archival and longer term. And I would imagine I'm going to have to format shift. And another thing that I've often worried about in purchasing content from iTunes is what happens if Apple decides to change formats. If, M4A or M4V is not the, H.264 is not the video format 10 years from now, what am I going to do with this content? Is Apple going to let me format shift it? So there are some potential gotchas in the future with buying stuff digitally, and how that's going to be resolved, who knows? There's also the whole legacy thing is I can't necessarily hand that content down to future generations. It's sort of got a ticking time bomb on it to a certain degree. And I know we've talked about some of these issues in the past about format shifting all of your content and what have you. As we move more and more stuff digitally, photos and stuff like that, do you want to print out stuff so you have archival physical copies of this stuff? But even there, especially with digital content, there's no guarantee that you're going to be able to read a Blu-ray or a DVD on anything in the future. Imagine like what it would take for you now if you had to play back an 8-track tape. You might be able to find something, but maybe not. I have VHS tapes, and I think I have one VHS player left, but it's going to get harder and harder to buy those things. So these are definitely issues we need to think about, and Rick was very smart to point that out to me. So Rick, I'm going to be taking a few more precautions with my purchase content and actually backing it up, even though I really was hoping to avoid that, but now I'm hooked on the convenience of buying stuff digitally through the iTunes store. So I don't think I can go back to purchasing physical media, so I'm gonna have to just bite the bullet and man up and do what I need to do with respect to backups. And I would encourage anybody else to consider it as well. And then finally, in the feedback and questions for this week, I received this comment from Lisa, who's been struggling with her late 2012 Mac Mini.
Hey Adam, it's Lisa Sievert, giving you an update about HDMI out problems on late 2012 Mac Minis. I just installed 10.8.3. It did not fix the problem. I've now tried three different monitors. I've had to completely give up on the brand new 27-inch Samsung that I bought, which I took home and attached to my old Mac Mini, and it looks great. But late 2012 just looked terrible, kept blanking out. And so now I've just got it attached to an old old monitor, and it still keeps blacking out regularly. I'm actually going to try taking it back to the Apple Store. Anyway, that's my update. Thanks.
Hey, Lisa. Sorry to hear you're having all that trouble with your late 2012 Mac Mini. I think I had heard about some issues when it first came out. And as a matter of fact, I went online and did some checking. And sure enough, there was, not long after it came out, a firmware update for that model. I think it was firmware update 1.7, if I'm getting the version number correct. But I don't know if you had run that on your system or not. Maybe that's worth checking into. I would assume, because I think that came out in November, December, not long after that, that you likely have already run that. I mean, if you ran software update since then, and it sounds like you ran 10.8.3 recently, you would have received that update already. So I'm not convinced that that is where your trouble lies. There is a large number of discussions, including a full 74-page discussion on Apple's discussion boards that is talking about this issue specifically. So you definitely aren't alone. I'll have a link to that full thread in the show notes at maccast.com, although a number of people in that thread are reporting that 10.8.3 did seem to resolve the issue for them, or at least they think it did. But ultimately, it looks like the problem is different for different users. You connect via HDMI and you get kind of fuzzy images, or it sounds like in your case, you're getting the blanking out issue. There's a number of different issues kind of being reported. The issue does seem to be only in going from HDMI, on the Mac Mini to HDMI on the monitor, at least from what I'm reading and what I understand. So some users report that if you do an HDMI to DVI cable, that that looks great. If you do HDMI to HDMI under boot camp, so if you boot into Windows and do HDMI to HDMI, it seems to be fine. And so that does seem to point to potentially some sort of operating system issue related to HDMI and the 2012 Mac Mini. So that seems a little bit odd, but seems to jive with the reports that are out there. So the good news on that is it should be something that Apple could address with a software update and wouldn't require, you know, getting any kind of new hardware. And doesn't seem to be something inherently flawed with their, say, HDMI chipsets. So that would be good news. You know, for your thing, I have to wonder if I'm assuming your monitor didn't just have an HDMI port. Like, I have an HP 24-inch display that I use, and I am hooking that up through HDMI to DVI. So just getting a different cable might get you through, at least until Apple can maybe patch this up. But I wanted to throw this out there in case any of you have run into similar experiences or issues or thoughts with doing HDMI to an HDMI monitor from, it could be a late 2012 Mac Mini or any other model that you maybe had issues with. And if you know any potential workarounds or obvious solutions that maybe we haven't tried. I think we can assume Lisa's done most of the standard things, updating the firmware, trying out different cables, different monitors. Obviously, it sounds like you've bought a couple different monitors, Lisa. So I think you've gone through all the standard stuff, and we're kind of down to more of maybe software issues or other little hacks or tweaks that you might be able to do to fix things up. But you're looking for, it sounds like, generally better quality HDMI display reliability when going from a late 2012 Mac Mini to an HDMI display using HDMI to HDMI. So if you have any suggestions for Lisa, shoot me an email and I'll try and pass those along. But with that, I think that's going to do it for the MacCast for this week. Before I leave you, I do want to take a quick moment and thank all of my show sponsors. Circus Ponies, makers of Notebook. You can check out their software. Get more information and details over at circusponies.com. Smile, go grab your copy of PDF Pen version 6, either PDF Pen or PDF Pen Pro, available now through the App Store or on Smile's website over at smilesoftware.com. GoToMeeting by Citrix. Try GoToMeeting free for 30 days. Just visit GoToMeeting.com, click the Try It Free button, and use my promo code MACCAST. Gazelle, the fast and simple way to sell your used gadgets. Find out what your iPhone, your iPad, your MacBook, your Samsung Galaxy S, or other smartphone is worth by going to gazelle.com. Squarespace, the beautiful and intuitive website publishing platform that allows anyone to create a professional web page, blog, online store, or gallery all on a single platform. You can try it free, no credit card required. Just go to squarespace.com/maccast to sign up now. And if you purchase a new account, you can save 10% off by entering the offer code MACCAST3. Everything you need to create an exceptional website over at squarespace.com/maccast. And ShareFile by Citrix. Take all the hassle out of sharing and sending your business files via old methods like email attachments, FTP with ShareFile. You can try it risk-free for 30 days. Just go to ShareFile.com, click on the radio microphone, and enter my offer code MACCAST. ShareFile.com. And a big thank you to all of my sponsors for their support of the MACCAST. Big thank you to you for your support. I love hearing from you. If you have a comment, a question, a response to one of the things that we had in this episode, you can send your emails and audio comments to MACCAST@gmail.com. You can also call in on the listener hotline, leave a voicemail there. It's 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IAM-9. You can leave voicemail on Skype. My Skype address is the MACCAST. And if you need show notes, links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MACCAST, you can go to the website. That's at maccast.com. And while you're there, be sure to check out the forum at forum.maccast.com. And that's, remember, where that AppleScript is if you want to set up the folder action for changing your shared permissions on your Mac. And if you'd like to follow me on Twitter, you can find me at twitter.com/MACCAST, also on Google Plus, and be sure to check out the MACCAST Facebook page over at facebook.com/TheMACCAST. But with that, that'll do it for this week. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.